Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you. Be seated, please.
Good morning. Welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court. Thursday, April 10, 2025, sitting in Lewiston, Idaho today. We appreciate being here, this part of the state, as part of our constitutional obligation to travel, and we're pleased to have a couple of hearings here today. First matter before us is a case entitled Ramlo v. Mitchell 51721. This is brought by appellant Nicholas Ramlo, who's representing himself this morning. You are Nicholas Ramlo, sir?
Yes, Chief Justice.
Thank you. The respondents are two. One is Amanda Mitchell, represented by Samantha Hammond, and second respondent Miriam McBenge, represented by John J. Moss, with James R. Stoll appearing only. It appears that Ms. Hammond, you and Mr. Moss have split time equally, and you'll begin your argument. Is that correct? Do any of you have anything preliminary to your argument today? Appears not. Very well. Mr. Ramlo, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please this court. Under Idaho law, parents who have legal custody of their children have the fundamental right to make decisions concerning their children's education, including the right to cause their children to be educated in a public school of their choosing. In furtherance of parental choice in education, in 2023, the Idaho legislature significantly constrained the ability of public schools to deny out-of-district transfers by prohibiting residence-based discrimination and imposing a conjunctive standard requiring every public school district to both receive and admit pupils transferred thereto. Figuratively speaking, if a parent were a quarterback and a school a wide receiver, the new legislation required the school to receive any pass made by the parent and score a touchdown after. The pass cannot be dropped, and the line to gain must be made. Additionally, under Idaho law, joint legal custodians are required to share educational decisions with the other legal custodian. Appellant, having shared the decision to transfer his minor child and hearing no objection from the other legal custodian, the underlying controversy in this case results from Appley's failure to receive and admit said pupil after Appellant submitted an application for transfer.
Mr. Ramlo, sorry to interrupt, but I have a question. In your reply brief, you seem to concede that a writ of mandamus against Ms. McBenge is no longer being pursued. Is that correct?
That is correct, Justice Meyer. After briefing the issues, it's apparent that a cause of action under 1983 is available. And the writ will not issue if there another remedy is available.
Okay. And in the petition that you filed in this case, the only cause of action that you have against Ms. McBenge is for a writ of mandamus, correct?
Yes, Justice Meyer.
And you have also filed another action in Kootenai County alleging 1983 relief, correct?
Yes, Justice Meyer.
What are you asking us to do?
Well, the dismissal with prejudice foreclosed on all claims except for any future occurrence by McBenge.
All right.
And so,
with respect to the motion for reconsideration, in the order of the district court directed the dismissal with prejudice and changed it to a dismissal without prejudice. In that case, how are your claims affected?
I don't recognize that the order dismissed it without prejudice. It just made a clarification that the issues were to be resolved by the magistrate court. I don't believe that it amended the prejudicial effect.
You might want to take a look at that. I think toward the end of the order on reconsideration, the district court clarified that the dismissal should be without prejudice. Assuming that's the case, what do you want us to do?
What I'm seeking the court to do is a reversal of the district court's decision. A certification, because this is the first time that a cause of action of this type has been able to be brought on an individual basis based in the decision and fails. Certification that it is plausible to bring that type of action in Idaho.
Which type of action?
Under 1983. And that's based in the decision and fails, which strictly says that parents do not have a cause of action under 1983 to enroll a child in a public school of their choosing, which is exactly the case I'm stating here. That right does exist in Idaho. Alternatively, there is the creation of a cause of action under 32-1013, which provides relief, but it doesn't state the type of relief. I think under that code, it would be similar to the impermissible interference in family association or unreasonable seizure of property interest under the Fourth Amendment, similar to the 1983 statute.
What I'm struggling to understand is where you have filed a new action containing the Section 1983 causes of action, why do we continue with this case?
Well, that case was simply brought so that I could bring my claims forward, and it was subsequently stayed pending review of this court in the first instance.
But what difference does it make in the end whether your 1983 claims, which weren't alleged in this case, at least not yet, but you're saying you could seek to amend, I guess.
Certainly.
Is that what you're saying?
Certainly.
But you already have them in another case.
Certainly.
I don't know what's left to do here.
The holding by the court is that it's the magistrate's, that the decision of whether or not the child should be enrolled in the school is within the power of the magistrate court to decide, and I disagree with that position. And until the order is either set aside or vacated, it's considered valid, and I don't, absent an objection by the other custodian and in the initiation of custody action, I simply do not agree with the proposition that the magistrate court has any power to influence the outcome. And that's really the biggest issue on appeal, is to say that the decision to enroll the child is in the hands of the magistrate court, which I believe it certainly is not.
So let's move then to where you began. Heaven knows I like a good sports analogy, but you compared this to the parent being like the quarterback, school district being the receiver. Isn't the problem here, though, that we have two quarterbacks? And they each get to pick which receiver they want to throw it to?
Well, thank you, Justice Mohler. I think that's a good point. And that's where misconduct comes into play and the failure to share an educational decision in the first instance. I think the court touched on this, got close to it in Gray using the Roberts rule, which is just the shifting of the burden. But by adopting my procedural one of the things when enforcing decision-making powers within the family courts is that we often refer back to the factors under 32-717 to resolve the underlying issue. Is it in the child's best interest? What I'm trying to get at is that if we adopt the procedural nexus under the term share, which doesn't mean that the parties are to agree, it just means that they're required to give notice to the other party before the decision is made, or at the time the decision is made. What happens there is we can distinguish between when a party conceals the decision, which is a badge of fraud, which implicates misconduct, compared to where the parties simply disagree over the decision. And so the courts can kind of distinguish between, say, an unreasonable decision per se.
So why can't the magistrate make that decision? Isn't that exactly what magistrates who preside over family courts do? They decide who the quarterback is. They decide which parent makes these kind of decisions, or they decide how the two parents together can make a decision.
No, Your Honor, Justice Mohler, I believe that if the parents share the decision, That decision is still within the nuclear family, and it's presumptively in the best interest of the child at the time it was made, unless two things happen. One of the parties objects, and two, they seek to either modify the arrangement or to stay the decision. It's when the second party acts to stop the decision-making process. That's when the magistrate court comes into play. Absent disagreement, we don't have a disagreement in this case.
That may be true if you're still married to the child's mother, but if you're divorced, doesn't it have to be a bilateral decision unless one party is authorized to make a unilateral decision?
And my argument is that it is bilateral by sharing it.
By waiver.
If I tell the other party, hey, I plan to make this decision, I'm going to do this, and they sit on their rights, that decision was shared, for sure. And I have satisfied my obligations under the statute.
Where in Idaho law does it say that a custodial divorced parent waives their rights because they don't reply to an extraneous legal proceeding that you've brought?
It doesn't mean that they waive their rights. It's just that they didn't raise them.
Well, they've raised them now.
It's not in the record. There's no objection in the record.
I get the impression from the briefing that they oppose this.
She opposes the relief sought in terms of the cause of action. Their arguments have principally been based on the fact that the magistrate is the court where has the decision-making power to decide whether or not the child should be enrolled in the school. I haven't seen the word objection or that Ms. Mitchell disagrees with enrolling the child in the school at all. And it's specifically at the time the decision was made, not 2 years later in briefing. I think what's critical to this case is that occurred not after I brought a cause of action seeking a writ of mandamus months later, but to raise the objection months, years later. Yes,
Mr. Granlow, I guess my struggle is I don't know that the law says the failure to respond equals consent in this instance. I think there's a distinction between the failure to respond to your telling her I intend to do this versus her affirmatively consenting to allow her to be enrolled. And I'm not sure that the law says in this instance her failure to respond means you get to do this. I'm concerned that the law may be she has to affirmatively consent or it does not happen.
Certainly, and that's why I point to the code which says that, you know, if a parent abandons their child or refuses to exercise custody, I use the word custody broadly as upstream from the legislature's bifurcation in 717B of physical and legal custody. I see that statute applying to legal custody decisions. If another legal custodian just refrains from exercising their fundamental rights, then the party who is affirmatively exercising their fundamental rights, that they're presumptively acting in the best interest of the child at the time that they made whatever legal decision they make.
And so when Ms. Mitchell continues to take the child to Pinehurst Elementary, isn't that her exercising her rights and what she believes is best for the child? I mean, how do we not draw that inference that the fact she didn't consent to enroll the child at the elementary school you sought to enroll her at, but instead continued to have her enrolled at Pinehurst and take her to Pinehurst? Why isn't that evidence that that's the exercise of her parental rights?
I guess the failure to act, and so just continuing the status quo, I don't know how we get there as to be an affirmative act of a fundamental right.
But isn't the decision not to respond to your email or letter, I can't remember how you notified her, but you told her, I intend to do this, can't we take her failure to respond to that and the fact she continued to take the child to Pinehurst to be her asserting her right, no, I'm going, I want her to go here, I'm going to take her here?
I didn't consider it that way. It's not in the record. So in terms of whether or not she intended to do that, hasn't been established as a, and so it would be disputed that that was the case. It's more likely that Ms. Mitchell was just trying to protect her liability under contempt by remaining silent.
But circling back to Justice Mueller's question where we have these issues, doesn't it make sense to have the family law court and the magistrate judge that has jurisdiction over the divorce, over custody, sort out who did what, was it right, you know, who gets to make this decision, how do we sort this out if you and Ms. Mitchell can't agree? Doesn't it make sense to take that dispute to that judge who's already familiar with both of you, familiar with the case, familiar with the child, and have that judge sort that out?
There is a pending case in front of that judge, but no party has raised school enrollment issues. And the reason why is because those decisions have already been exercised without objection. And so my answer is no. Absent an objection by a legal custodian, the power of the court to take over that decision doesn't exist. And I think that's what Pierce is telling us.
But that's where I realize you want an affirmative objection. You want her to write back or say, I object. But I'm asking, isn't her refusal to consent to the enrollment equivalent to an objection?
I don't think that would be consistent with any of the applicable case law on failing to act. I don't think failing to act is in any way an affirmative gesture. And even if we did assume that that was the case, I really think that the case law with my adoption of the procedural nexus using the word chair, I really think that there's room for a bright line rule. Oftentimes we use the best interest of the child standard, but what I was getting to is the element of misconduct when a party conceals and doesn't affirmatively share the decision, whatever that decision may be, education, medical, transferring the child out of the state. I think there's room for an unreasonableness standard to say that that decision was unreasonable per se, absent notice to the offended party.
But that involves, you're alleging she violated a prior order in the family law case, and so isn't that for the magistrate judge to sort out? I'm trying to figure out, what does that have to do with this case here?
And so violating the court order is an issue on contempt. Deciding to move the child back into the school district from which she absconded was removed. I took it away from the court's power by removing it from my pleadings in the contempt, by refusing to seek a sanction. And I simply exercised what the law prescribes, which is notice to the other party before the exercise of the fundamental right. And then I just waited for her to either respond or not respond, and then I exercised it. And so I really think that that's, and the thing is that I spent substantial time trying to figure out how in the heck this, the legislature's prescribed conduct, to come up with the sanctions on contempt. It was all procedural and all squarely fits within the term share. As being a procedural nexus and not a substantive one.
You mentioned Pierce earlier. That certainly is an important case. In that case, though, the parents were married. Do you know of any case law that allows one parent in a divorce situation to override the decision of another parent when the case is being monitored by a magistrate?
And that's the thing. The key phrase is override. To override a decision, we presume that there's some sort of objection made. And so there's no overriding the other parent, absent the other parent coming to the table and saying, I want to do this instead.
So is that really what this is all about, a semantic misunderstanding that your wife, your ex-wife, doesn't want to play some kind of game where she has to always object in writing to everything you want to do. So because of that, you somehow gain leverage over her and file a new action. This just seems like a semantic game you're playing here.
No, I'm applying Pierce, which is the magistrate court simply doesn't have jurisdiction to decide the issue absent an objection by the other party and initiating a custody action to have the question litigated. The presumption is that I am acting in my child's best interest. I think Ms. Mitchell, respondent, simply remained quiet, not because she objects to the child going to the school, because he's currently enrolled in a terrible school, but because she simply wanted to mitigate any liability on contempt by making admission that, yes, he's currently enrolled in this other school that I...
Returning to your football analogy, this sounds like you're trying to change the referee.
Well, this is so referring to a different...
You're trying to force this decision, which is already being entrusted to one referee, and you're looking for a referee from a different league to decide the case now.
To your point, Justice Mueller, my football analogy has to do with 33-1404. So a different part of the code from the magistrate's jurisdiction to decide the issue. That really just has to do with whether or not there's a clearly mandated duty by the school to both receive and admit a pupil that's been transferred there too. And so that's really my analogy, is when a parent who is the trustee and arbiter of their child's interests tells a school that I want to transfer my child, the statute says that the absent a determination, there's four exceptions. There's a limit to four exceptions, which the school can say no, essentially. But outside of those four exceptions, the school is required to both receive and admit the pupil. And so my point is simply that the presumption is that I'm acting in my best interests, absent. And this gets to the Leavitt Court, which I was going to discuss in my opening, which is the Leavitt Court recognized that 32-71 said the Leavitt Court imposed a conjunctive standard as well. 32-717 only applies to both equal and competing fundamental interests. And that's my point. We haven't established a competing fundamental interest in this case. There's been no objection, and there's been no case initiated in the magistrate division by the respondent seeking to stay or stop enforcement or keep my child from being enrolled in that school. And I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Very well, thank you. Ms. Hammond.
Thank you. And may it please the court, my name is Samantha Hammond. I represent respondent appellee Amanda Mitchell. She could not be here today. This case essentially involves a writ of mandamus against the Coeur d'Alene School District, and specifically Marion, and I will always not say her name correctly, but McBain, who is the secretary of the Bryant Elementary School in Coeur d'Alene. And the second essential issue is that Mr. Ramlow, the appellant, is asserting, I believe it's an equitable estoppel and quasi-estoppel declaratory judgment is what he's seeking against Ms. Mitchell, essentially asking this court to rule that she has waived her right on the child's school enrollment by essentially remaining silent when he had requested that the minor child be enrolled in Bryant Elementary. The history of this case is what is essential in deciding it. The parties do have one minor child together, a son. He was born in 2015, so he is now 10 years old. The parties were never married, but there was an order for filiation, child custody, and child support, which was the initial order, entered in 2016. So when the child was just over a year and a half years old. The original judgment that had been entered allowed the parties to have a phased-in type of parenting plan, and it anticipated that the parties would revisit the parenting plan this summer before the minor child began kindergarten because school enrollment had not yet been decided at that point in time. During this time, Ms. Mitchell resided in the Coeur d'Alene area, so Coon County area, and Mr. Ramlow resided in Kalispell, Montana, or Flathead County, Montana. That is approximately 3 hours, three-plus hour drive from between the parties' residences. At the time, prior to the minor child beginning kindergarten, the parties did attend mediation twice, were unable to resolve their issues regarding a custody plan that contemplated the child going to kindergarten. And so they, Ms. Mitchell filed a petition to modify the custody action in the magistrate court. During that time, which was right before the minor child began kindergarten, Ms. Mitchell enrolled the child in what was Winton Elementary School in Coeur d'Alene, which was her home district at the time, for the minor child to begin kindergarten. Mr. Ramlow then enrolled the child in the kindergarten in a school called Peterson Elementary in Kalispell, Montana. And that necessitated the court having to issue a temporary order regarding the child's school enrollment. Ms. Mitchell had requested in her temporary order that the minor child attend Winton Elementary School in Coeur d'Alene, which was her home district, and it also made sense considering that she had primary physical custody of the child and had him during the school week and during the days of school. And Mr. Ramlow at the time had it wasn't every other weekend, but it was first and third weekend of the month, which is oftentimes the way that they will describe the parenting plan to avoid any confusion. And at the time, the court entered a temporary order for the child to continue kindergarten in Winton Elementary, and that is what the temporary order states. It was regarding kindergarten. The issues that happened thereafter were, and just so it's clear, that order was entered, I believe, in July or August of 2020. So thereafter, there was still the pending custody modification to determine issues regarding custody with the child moving forward into kindergarten and school ages. Mr. Ramlow was then subject to two criminal actions. One was for two counts of stalking. One was for a domestic violence protection order violation. And there was also a protection order in place that protected the minor child, as well as no contact orders in the criminal case. While those were pending, the custody modification was set for trial. It went to the day before trial, the parties stipulated and agreed to what is in the current child custody order that the parties are now operating under. The only order or issue regarding school enrollment was raised at the time that the temporary orders were issued. That matter essentially resolved it on a temporary basis. The judgment for custody that the parties are currently operating under was silent as to school enrollment. That final judgment, which was entered April 14th of 2021, wholly superseded the temporary order that was entered. Therefore, that temporary order is no longer what is in effect, and the parties are operating under the current judgment, which again is silent as to school enrollment.
But it has joint legal custody.
It does, yes. That was entered, I said, in April of 2021. Thereafter, while the no contact order and the civil protection order were still in place, Ms. Mitchell moved to Shoshone County, which, as the court's probably familiar with the geography, is closer to where Mr. Ramlow was residing. So she did not move further away, thereby making the distance further. She actually moved approximately 40 minutes closer to Mr. Ramlow's home. And In the first judicial district, the court has attached what's called Appendix A to any custody orders, where part of Appendix A does require that the parties not move within 2 hour drive time from each other's home. So that provision did not necessarily apply in this case because the parties were already living more than 2 hours away. In fact, she moved closer. During this time that she moved, she enrolled the child in Pinehurst Elementary School. This would have been in approximately August of 2021, because he started the school year in Pinehurst for his first grade year. Again, the Ms. Mitchell did not have contact with Mr. Ramlow because of the no contact order, and that did not expire until, I believe, 2022. So she had moved to Pinehurst. She enrolled to Shoshone County. The child was enrolled in Pinehurst Elementary School, and he's been enrolled there since August of 2021.
Did your client ever inform Mr. Ramlow where the child was attending school after she moved?
No, because of the no contact order and the civil protection order, so she did not have any contact with them.
What about after the orders expired in 2022?
So, without knowing all the details of it, it's my understanding that there was no contact until approximately February or March of 2023. So even though all of the orders had expired, Mr. Ramlow did not seek contact with Ms. Mitchell until I believe it was February or March of 2023. So she did not inform him until after he had reached out to her.
So my question related to her contact with him. So she waited until he contacted her?
Yes, that's my understanding.
And did she respond to him?
Yes, I know he, without knowing exactly what happened, I believe he already knew that she was residing in the Pinehurst area when he contacted her. So I don't think she formally said, hey, this is where we're living. But he seemed to have knowledge of that at that point in time. The way that he first made contact is by arriving at a baseball game, I believe. It's some sort of sporting event or practice that the minor child had. So he, Mr. Ramlow, appeared at that. So he knew that he was enrolled in this activity and attending school in Pinehurst. But she did not affirmatively reach out and tell him where she was living. And thereafter, there was a contempt proceeding brought against Ms. Mitchell for moving and various other actions. And then the civil protection order was also appealed to the Supreme Court as well. So Mr. Ramlow, I believe it's in his brief, he did request that or give notice to Ms. Mitchell that he had filed an application with this Bryant Elementary School and that he was intending to enroll the child there. The school is not a school that the minor child had ever attended. He had only attended Winton Elementary for 1 year for kindergarten. And I believe the briefing from Ms. McBain was that she had responded to the application and that she had informed both of the parties. And at that time, Ms. Mitchell had informed Ms. McBain that the child was already enrolled in Pinehurst and that she did not intend to transfer the minor child's enrollment to Bryant Elementary at that time.
Before you run out of your time, of course, you can continue on. What do you request that the court does with this appeal?
Essentially dismiss the appeal, affirm the district court's ruling, and allow the magistrate court to make these decisions. This has been a theme throughout different cases that Mr. Ramlow has filed against Ms. Mitchell. And essentially we have continually asked the courts to rule that the magistrate court is appropriate court in which to make decisions regarding the custody, education, and care of the minor child going forward. There is an open case, a modification case for custody, where Mr. Ramlo is requesting that he be awarded sole legal custody of the minor child and primary physical custody of the minor child, and that he be allowed to relocate with the minor child back to Montana, assuming he would seek enrollment in a school in Kalispell, Montana. I don't know why the case that we are present here for today is so important, considering that is his intention and his request requested relief from the magistrate court, not to have the child remain in the Coeur d'Alene area with him and be enrolled in Bryant Elementary, but that he is requesting to move to Montana and enroll the child there.
Address, if you will, Mr. Ramlo's contention that Ms. Mitchell did not object to Mr. Ramlo's intention to enroll the child in Bryant Elementary.
It depends on the facts of the specific case. Given the nature of the criminal cases and the civil protection order, Ms. Mitchell is terrified of Mr. Ramlo. She did not want to have contact with him any more than necessary. She did not affirmatively object in writing saying, no, I do not agree with that. But certainly by her actions and her contact with the school district, informing them that she did not consent to transfer the minor child, as well as continuing to keep the minor child in the Pinehurst school district, should certainly put him on notice of her intent to not transfer jurisdiction. Further, from a practical standpoint, it doesn't make sense. She has primary custody of the child. Mr. Ramlo didn't have contact with the child for approximately 3 years because of these no contact orders. And then her having to resume parenting time where she still has a minor child every day during the school week, except for every other weekend with Mr. Ramlo, she would be driving approximately a 40-minute drive each way to bring the minor child to school in a school district that she no longer resides in and has no connections with in terms of school enrollment.
I'm going to ask a question that sounds critical, and I don't mean it to, so I apologize.
No,
no tone is intended here. But given the fact that Mr. Ramlo's whole theory of the case is predicated on the fact that there hasn't been an express rejection of his proposal, and I understand your reasons why you believe that wasn't necessary, I'm just wondering if it might have made this case go away if she had just had her attorney send a letter to Mr. Ramlo saying, we wish the child to remain at Pinehurst.
Certainly, and perhaps that is something that should have been done. To be perfectly honest, in dealing with Mr. Ramlo and various cases, it's hard to know exactly what will appease the situation, but that certainly could have been another way of addressing it, is, hey, we disagree with this.
It would certainly cut the legs out from under a lot of what we just heard.
Certainly, absolutely. And I agree with that. Considering that is a big part of Mr. Ramlo's argument today. But again, both parties should, having joint legal custody, agree to these types of issues. And in the event they cannot agree, then the proper place to bring that disagreement would be the magistrate court that is the proper jurisdiction or authority in order to make these determinations when the parties cannot agree on something as important as enrollment of a child and their education. I believe I'm out of time, so I don't want to interfere with their time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jamie Moss, and I am honored to represent the respondent in this case, Miriam McBenge, the secretary of Bryant Elementary. This case is a backdoor custody modification, and we are respectfully asking this court to affirm the lower court's dismissal of this action for three independent reasons. First, the lower court properly deferred to the jurisdiction of the magistrate court under Rule 12b-8. Second, the appellant has abandoned his only claim against respondent Big Bench, and this appeal now seeks impermissible relief. And finally, appellant has failed to exhaust his administrative remedies, leaving the lower court without subject matter jurisdiction over the writ. Beginning with the first issue.
Could you turn to Justice Meyer's question about the dismissal of the action with prejudice, and specifically the paragraph of the reconsideration order? Does it look like the magistrate or the district court reversed course on the dismissal? That is, was it without prejudice or was it with prejudice?
It was without prejudice, Your Honor. The record at page 433 is the reconsideration order, where the lower court granted the appellant's reconsideration motion with respect to changing the dismissal to be without prejudice. And that is also reiterated on the corrected order at page 413 and 414.
Is there actually an amended judgment entered without prejudice?
Yeah, I think that the court entered an order nunc-pro-tunc that made the corrections to the dismissal without prejudice, as well as corrected some typographical errors that were in the original order.
I believe that order still says it's with prejudice, the nunc-pro-tunc.
I am not certain about that, Your Honor.
Page 381, order of dismissal with prejudice, nunc-pro-tunc to February 4th, 2024.
Oh, well, that may be a procedural error, but the lower court did grant the reconsideration motion and did specify in its order on the motion for reconsideration that the dismissal would be without prejudice.
Honestly, I'm a little bit confused by it. I mean, I realize what you're saying about the conclusion and order, but if you look at the text, it says petitioner also asked the court to amend the dismissal to be without prejudice. The court, upon further reflection, finds the petitioner should not be precluded from bringing an action against the respondent Bench in the event the minor child of petitioner and respondent Mitchell comes to reside in the district boundaries of Bryant Elementary School, and there's a corresponding action moving forward. So it looks to me, as I read it, that paragraph is saying, moving forward, if there's a violation, then he's not precluded from this action. But there's nothing that deals with, I think to Mr. Ramlo's point, there's nothing that addresses his prior claim. And so I get confused by this paragraph.
That's fair. And in the district, and Respondent McBench has never asked the court to specifically enter a condition that the only time that appellant is allowed to seek enrollment of the child is where both of the parents reside within the district.
Wait a minute, say that again?
The district's position has never been that the only way that appellant would ever have a cause of action against the school district is if both parents reside within the Coeur d'Alene school district. The court did orally grant the motion to reconsider for dismissal without prejudice, and while its order on the motion for reconsideration is not exactly precisely clear, that was the effect of the lower court's oral ruling and in its granting in the motion of reconsideration where appellant asked for it to be dismissed without prejudice.
Sorry, I wanted to build on Justice Brody's question, though, because I don't see an amended judgment that says dismissed without prejudice. The one judgment I see is the February 2nd, February 6th judgment that it says dismissed with prejudice. So did the district court enter an amended judgment somewhere after it ruled on the motion for reconsideration?
I had thought that it had, but if it hadn't, it certainly should. And to the extent that the lower court needs to enter that, that would be an appropriate subject for remand. But that doesn't mean that this court should remand the entire case so that we ultimately go to trial on the issue of the writ of mandate, or that this case should proceed any further. It was my understanding that the corrected order had been entered, but if that isn't the case, We're not arguing that this case should be dismissed with prejudice.
Well, and we're distinguishing, right, the difference between an order and a judgment is really important. And you keep referring to an order, and I'm asking about an amended judgment, because even though he enters an order saying it, for it to carry through, he then needs to enter an amended judgment. And so that's why I'm asking. I've now shifted off of the order, and I'm asking, okay, if it was really without prejudice, where's the amended judgment that says that?
Well, I thought that the district court had entered an amended judgment, and if it has not, that should occur.
And I guess if a future action is filed, the petitioner, or the appellant in this case, would be able to use the order to suggest that the prior dismissal was not without, was without prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor. Turning to the 12b8 action,
Do we need to reach this? If given the concessions by the appellant here, that it appears that, for lack of a better word, he's abandoned the writ of mandamus action, do we ever reach the 12b8 issues in this case?
That's fair. I do think that appellant has abandoned this cause of action against Respondent McBench, and that this relief is essentially asking this court to set up the third case that he's filed on this same set of facts. However, we are also asking for this court to provide a little bit of clarity to school secretaries in interpreting the law and understanding what to do in terms of Idaho's open enrollment statutes and how that intersects with their obligation to enroll out-of-state districts, especially where there is a custody order such as this.
Well, your client suggested there was a policy. Is there a policy? And if so, is that in the record?
The policy is in the record, Your Honor. It is attached to the declaration of Miriam McBench. In addition, the appellant was notified in this case that what essentially happened was that the appellant submitted a transfer application citing Respondent Mitchell's home address as the primary address, and also attached an email that provided a 15-paragraph statement of facts concluding that mom had waived her right to object and attached the joint custody order. And what he essentially was asking Respondent McBench to do was interpret the custody order, rule in favor of his theory of waiver, and enroll the child, even though the child was already enrolled in a second school district, had already been attending that school district for about 4 years, and essentially, Respondent McBench is in this action because she refused to wade into the custody dispute, and she simply asked appellant to come back with either a clarifying order from the magistrate court or with the consent of mom.
Well, I want to go back to where Justice Mueller started, which is the policy. I'm on the record at page 194. That's where I see the policy that was attached to the notice of errata regarding the declaration of Miriam McBench. Point to me in that policy what the district contends guided the secretary's actions in this case.
Well, Your Honor, when there's issues of joint custody, there is, and I couldn't find it for you right this second, but the district policy was essentially that the child's primary residence is considered their home residence.
Let me stop you. This policy, 3001, it looks like. What language in there governs custody issues, what the district does whenever there are child custody issues with divorced parents?
I'm sorry, where are you at, Your Honor?
I'm on page 194 of the record. It's section 3000 of the policy manual, code section 3001, enrollment, qualifications, entrance, placement, and credit acceptance. Thank you.
Well, the initial paragraph, Your Honor, references that students may seek admission as set forth in the Idaho Code, the rules of the State Board of Education, and district policies. And the Idaho Code that has been cited by appellants does provide that a student is not to be admitted into a district. And this is Idaho Code Section 33-14033 that says, no pupil shall be transferred to any school without the notification and consent of the pupil's parent or guardian. The fundamental thing here is that Respondent McBenge was essentially told that this child's primary residence is with the mom, and was told that mom had waived her right to object. And although Respondent McBenge does references the child's primary residence, which was with mom in Shoshone County, Respondent McBenge was not comfortable enrolling the child into two separate school districts. And the district's attorney, Ms. O'Dowd, sent appellant a letter to that effect, which is located at pages 40 and 41 of the record, where she says that these educational decisions with joint custody must be made jointly, and that appellant is free to come back, and they are happy to enroll the child with mom's consent and with a court order. And that is all that Respondent McBenge is necessarily supposed to wade into the dispute between the parties. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I'm not sure I had a question on that point. I'm not sure that I agree in terms of the idea that the district didn't want or was trying to avoid the problem. It seems to me that we have situations where divorced parents with joint physical and legal custody of their children can make decisions, huge decisions for their children, including the decision to marry, author to consent to an underage marriage, that they can do that without the consent of the other parent. Idaho law allows that. And so it seems to me when the district has no policy about what to do when the parents are divorced, what to do when there's joint physical custody, whether they don't have a policy that says both parents have to consent when there's joint physical and legal custody, then I don't understand why the district in that situation said, I can't take your enrollment application. I won't enroll your child. It seems to me the district waded into the problem. It could have just enrolled the child and let the parents deal with the problem in the magistrate court.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, that also presents an administrative problem for the school district, right? The Idaho statutes do not contemplate that a student is going to be enrolled in two elementary schools, and Idaho law does not empower parents to, so if dad has custody the first half of the week and mom the second half, that the school attends two school districts during that week. And at the end of the day, the magistrate court is the court that makes, I see I'm out of time.
You can finish your comment in response to the question.
Thank you, Your Honor. The magistrate court is empowered to make an interest, a judgment call in the best interest of the child. And Mary McBenge is not a judge, she is not an arbiter of parental disputes, and it is against policy for a child to be enrolled in two school districts at once.
What policy prohibits the child from being enrolled in two different districts? What statute? What policy?
Well, the Idaho statutes require that the schools submit attendance records. I mean, education touches on the child's stability, continuity, the school's funding, their access to transportation, social services, and the school district's obligations to that child. And that cannot really happen if the child is only attending school in one district two days a week, in the other district 3 days a week, especially if they're 40 minutes apart and in separate districts. That is not a favorable result. And that is why legal custody is within parental control, and when there's a dispute, it is entrusted to the magistrate court to make that decision, not an elementary school secretary. For these reasons, We ask this court affirm dismissal.
Chief, can I ask a question? All right. Oh, I'm going to bring us back to the 12B8. Why isn't McBenge's approach to litigate this and tell the district court, I can't enroll if I don't have consent of both parents? Why, where we don't have anything pending in the magistrate court vis-a-vis where the child is going to attend school, why does McBenge get to say, no, kick it back there, instead of defending the decision not to enroll in front of the district court?
I'm sorry, could you restate that for me, Your Honor?
There's nothing pending in the mat. There may be a family law case in the magistrate court, but there's nothing pending about where the child goes to school. So I'm struggling with why McBenge gets to say, dismiss the case against me for not enrolling and send it to magistrate court. There's nothing pending specifically in magistrate court about enrollment. Why doesn't McBenge need to defend in front of the district court and say, Your Honor, I did not have both parents consenting. I could not enroll.
Your Honor, we did raise that below. We did point out to the district court that we were not, that the school secretary is not just going to duly enroll.
Right, but you moved to dismiss the case on the basis of 12B8. And I'm struggling to understand why your client gets to bring the 12B8 when her response is simply, I don't have a court order and I don't have both parents consenting. There's nothing, I'm struggling with what is going to happen in the magistrate court that's going to resolve her defense, which is I don't have legal authority to enroll because I don't have a court order and I don't have consent from both parents.
Yes, Your Honor, because Idaho Code 33717 grants the magistrate court with continuing jurisdiction over custody matters, which includes the education of the child. And there is an open case, and there are active orders. And what this writ is essentially asking for is a backdoor custody modification, where instead of taking this dispute to the magistrate court and having it weigh the best interests of the children, they are asking a different court to essentially summarily demand that this child be enrolled over the wishes on the other child of the other child based on a specific interpretation, appellant's interpretation of the custody order. So the 12B8 motion is essentially a recognition that even if that issue is not actively pending, but there is a court that has jurisdiction over this question, and this court is recognized in cases like Biggers versus Biggers, that the purpose of the continuing jurisdiction of the magistrate court is to ensure that children are not shuffled from courthouse to courthouse.
Right, but as to your client, I don't know why any of that matters. As I understand your argument, your client's response is, I don't have an order telling me to enroll him here. I don't have both parents agreeing to enroll him here. Therefore, I cannot enroll. Why does your client's liability depend at all on what the magistrate court ends up deciding to do with custody and education and all of that? It strikes me your client's defense is now. And so I'm not sure what your client, I know your client would like clarification, but in terms of the claim pled, my understanding is you're saying there's no liability here because there's no clear authorization or order that the child be enrolled at Bryant.
Yes, Your Honor. And as we raised below, that's the first element of a writ of may, is that there be a certain insurer entitlement to relief. And our point is that by not going before the magistrate court, he hasn't gotten that. And in addition,
That's sufficient.
That's sufficient.
I know you're over your time, and the chief gave me a little bit of latitude, so.
Right. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
8 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think it was, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was Justice Moeller, you wanted me to cite a case where they had held that silence, a parent can't be silent or something to that regard. I couldn't recall exactly. But in my opening brief, page 29, I cite Madison v. Davis, which is a New Jersey Superior Court case from 2014, which held essentially that one legal custodian does not have the legal right to, quote, arbitrarily block or veto, end quote, another legal custodian's educational decision, quote, by simply refusing or failing to consent, end quote. And so that was the point I was getting to, is that the failure to act by a party does matter. And it is the affirmative raising the objection that really triggers the dispute between the parties. And absent a dispute, the only party who has decision-making power to enroll the child is me. That's the basis of my claim, and that's why this case is rooted in Pierce, is because that decision-making power doesn't leave my soul until there's a dispute exists.
So every time you unilaterally make a choice about this child and you communicate that to your ex-wife, she has to respond to each and every one of those proposals by you, or you have carte blanche to do whatever you want?
I think all parents have power to act carte blanche. Their requirement, based on what the legislature has prescribed, is simply to share those decisions before they do them. And that what that does is by it gives the other legal custodian both an opportunity to object and say, hey, I reference Wolf, which when one parent says, hey, I'm going to do X, it gives the other parent both the opportunity to negotiate different terms or litigate the issue.
Basically, that renders the orders meaningless then.
Which order?
The original orders bestowing your ex-wife the authority to make this decision.
It actually doesn't, under my legal theory, Justice Mueller. In fact, the reasonably informed provision doesn't exist in statute. It's a creature of contract. The judgment's based in stipulation. The reasonably informed provision is additive to the statutory construction.
It just sounds like a prescription for chaos to me.
Well, the idea was at the time the judgment was made, I was prohibited from contact with Ms. Mitchell. If we're stipulating to a modification to the judgment, which includes a reasonably informed provision, I would say that infers that I was saying, hey, I need to know the educational, medical, and general welfare of my child, and I'm ensuring that it's in our judgment, just to be sure. With regard to the points of contact orders, there is no order ever prohibiting Ms. Mitchell from contacting me. Any no contact.
If she did contact you and you engaged with her, wouldn't that have put you in violation of the orders prohibiting you from having contact with her?
I don't think that's applicable. I think the case law holds that a party who's subject to a no contact order cannot affirmatively contact the other party. But if they receive a communication, that's not a prohibition. There's no prohibition on the other party. In fact, the orders clarify, even if you're invited by the other party to talk, don't do it. And so
that's my point.
It's clearly within the law for Ms. Mitchell to contact me and notify me of parental decisions that she's making.
It's a decision you're attempting to make.
No. We're talking about during the pending no contact orders, which is long before the decision was made to transfer the child into the district. I'm just saying that there's no order prohibiting her from contacting me and keeping me reasonably informed of decisions that she's planning to make or did make with regard to my child.
Let's be real here for a minute. Do you have any doubt in your mind that she opposes this?
I do have doubt. In my mind, yes, Justice Miller.
You think she may secretly want this, and yet she hired an attorney to defend against
it? To your point, you said, wouldn't it be easier if you would just have said, hey, we oppose this? Certainly would. We would have avoided lots of litigating. And that's why I pointed to Madison v. Davis, which is basically, refusing or failing to consent simply to frustrate the rights of the other parent. This proceeding has been frustrated by what you might call obstinance and just a refusal to participate in the proceeding. I think most likely this could have been resolved with an objection or raising the issue in court, but I do not believe that Ms. Mitchell does heavily disagree with the child's.
I guess the danger is here. The danger here is looking at this in a vacuum, completely unaware of the history between you and your ex-wife. What you're saying could sound reasonable, but this case doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists within a history of criminal charges, protection orders, all kinds of things. If we look at it through that lens, her refusal to respond to every request you make, doesn't that look different?
Not to me, because I've never committed a crime and I've never committed stalking. So if we're going to rely on orders that I was asking this court to apply Munsingwer vacature for precisely because of their prejudicial effect on subsequent orders and judgments, if we're going to rely and look at those orders and apply that to this case at all, I don't see how this court can't reverse the decision in Mitchell v. Ramlow that was issued last fall, because there's clearly that would be a de facto prejudice stemming from those orders.
Have you asked in your briefing for us to reverse our prior decision against
you? I didn't think that it would be an issue because in my mind, there's no law, there's no prohibition on Ms. Mitchell providing me information. And really, that's issues on contempt. That just was grounds and a framework of how I came to arrive at the procedural nexus underlying the word share, which is reasonable notice and an opportunity to be heard. As regards to 33-1403, that wasn't raised in the briefs. I don't recall, but I believe that part of the code references the unilateral decision by either the school board or the trustee to transfer the child, not by the parent. So when the school says, hey, we're going to move your child into a different school, they are obligated to have both the consent of the parent and notify them. I believe that part of the code that was referenced is narrowly focused on the conduct of the school, not the parent. And also the issue of double enrollment was the first time raised at oral arguments today.
Sir, I'm sorry, but your time is up unless one of the justices has a question to extend your time. It appears they do not.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
With that, this matter is under advisement. We will render a decision in due course. We'll be in recess for approximately 10 minutes.
All rise, please.